So the issue is that I created an intro for this podcast already, and I spent a good 10 minutes pouring my heart out to you. This is all true, actually. I forgot to add myself to the stage. So I've started using a new recording software thingamajiggy online platform dealy called StreamYard. Hopefully you've noticed that the audio is better for the episodes like Stephen Pressfield and Moving Forward. Because that is why, or a large reason why I moved. There are a couple of other reasons, but that's the big one. That's the biggie, giving you better sound. That's what I want to do. I want you to have the best sound in the world when you listen to this podcast. So you think, hey, that Jody character, he really brings it in audio quality and content. I also believe that the reason that the last 10-minute intro didn't get to you is because it wasn't necessary. And so maybe there was a little bit of throat clearing going on, a little bit of self-exploration, that kind of thing. And so I'm going to do a very brief recap of that 10-minute recording to say that this is an atypical interview for me. And there are a host of reasons why I behave the way I do. But I think it is most important for you, the listener, to know that I am a jackass in this interview. I interrupt constantly. I challenge my guest, and I do a lot of ego posturing that makes me look really stupid. Being aware of that maybe is helpful, but it doesn't change the fact that I was not able to control myself. And for that, I want to ask your forgiveness. Like I said, there's a backstory, and I'm just aching to tell it to you. I already did once, but because that recording was lost because I didn't add myself to the stage, I believe that that is the signal from the universe saying, your listeners understand that humans are fallible, and an apology is all that is needed. And so I want to bring you this interview with Michael Kingswood in a spirit of hopefully humility, but the right kind of humility. I don't love that word, but here I want to use it because I am humbled by my behavior, and it's a lesson to me that no matter what excuse I think I have, treating every person with respect and dignity is important, and I didn't do that here. My apologies to you personally, Michael, but I still think you really hung in there like a champ and made a great interview out of this, and you deliver a lot of great information for the listeners. And lastly, I will say that despite the vessel which delivered the information, some of my interruptions, some of my protestations, some of my counters are also valuable. And so if you will, please try to forgive the guy who gave the interview and still hear the message he's delivering and incorporate that as well, because I do see that there's value here for you, and I'm really happy to bring you this episode. Please enjoy this interview with Michael Kingswood.
This is TRBM Ammo Edition. If you're a published author and want to make a living writing books and selling them to avid readers, you've come to the right place. There's simply no program that's more successful at driving readers towards the books you've written. So the only thing you have to worry about is writing a great book. And the system with Enamo takes care of the rest. Thanks for listening to this conversation.
Well, I'm definitely in it for the money. I don't know about you, but yeah. the career such as it is, never really planned to do it. And I grew up, I read too many Tom Clancy books, and I said, I'm going to be a submarine officer. So okay. I went to engineering school and became a submarine officer. did the Navy stuff for 20 years.
Okay.
But I kept on reading, I think my favorite authors were, for the longest time it was Jordan with the Wheel of Time series, and I'm reading that like, man, yeah. And I found his blog and I'm reading his blog. I was like, dude, it'd be cool to be this guy.
Yeah.
I was like, no way I could ever do anything like that though. But when he died and Brandon Sanderson took over, I was like, who the hell is this guy? And yeah. I found out he had a podcast. So I started listening to his podcast with his two buddies. I was like, yeah, that's neat. I also found George Martin's podcast and was just listening to them. It's like, yeah, mm-hmm. that's just nifty things of how you learn about, you know, people that you read. And then all of a sudden I get a call from my sister and she's like, "Hey, I wrote a book and it's getting published." And I'm like, "What? My younger sister?"
Yeah.
So I was like, "All right, that's it. I'm doing it too." So December timeframe of 2010.
Wow.
I got going on a thing and I'm cranking along. In January or so, I am realize, hey, if I'm going to do this, I should figure out how the whole thing works, because there's no point in writing something and not doing anything with it. So I was like, I hear you have to get an agent. I was like, is that true? I don't know. And then I found Dean was with Smith, and I found what's his name? The guy who was really big indie dude at the very beginning of the big Gold Rush period. He wrote the thrillers.
I think I know who you're talking about. Wore a mullet and sunglasses in almost all of his public appearances.
It'll
come to me.
I'm the worst at remembering names. Anyway, I found his blog and those two guys' blogs, and Dean in particular was like, "Don't get an agent, they're all crooks."
Yeah.
I was like, "Huh?" Yeah. And so I started reading more and learning more, and then learning more about the new indie thing that was going on. I was like, now I'm finishing up an MBA at this point.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, wait, I don't have to go through a bunch of jackasses in New York.
Yeah.
I don't have to. I was a Navy nuclear officer, right? I dealt with enough bureaucracy and weird rules and chicanery. I didn't want to deal with it in my fun stuff too. So I was like,
right,
I can, and I'm, you know, doing business school. I'm like, I can start my own business and do it myself. I'm there. Let's go.
Yeah.
So finished that first novel in May of that year and found out about Writers of the Future, started submitting to that. And just kind of been chugging along in fits and spurts ever since.
I'm trying to find that.
Go ahead. Some days, some years have been really bad in terms of production. Some years have been really good. Last year was really good because I was doing my short fiction challenge, and that helps. Mm-hmm. This year, I'm off to a slow start, but plan is to do a couple more, kickstart a couple novels in the next few months, and I made the big mistake that maybe a lot of people make, is I wrote a first novel intending for it to go into at least a small series. And then I wrote a different one and then turned that different one into a series that's now we're doing book 7 on it. And I'm looking back, it's like, wait, I never finished that first one. So I want to get that squared away.
So do you feel like you, you did like a, cliffhanger for the first series, or could you just leave it alone and it would stand alone? What's the thought process?
I mean, the story in it, that of that first one in and of itself ends nicely, but it's definitely not complete. It's not a cliffhanger. It's more like, okay, this section's done, but there's more to tell, and it's so I've got the sequel to it, you know, 10,000 words into it, and then I stopped and moved on to these other things. It's one of those classic things where you just getting started out and wasn't really thinking about how to properly.
Did you know it was going to be a series when you started, or did it sort of come to you along the way?
Yeah, pretty much.
You did. And then you just sort of got attracted to something else along the way.
More or less. And now I'm just going to go back and finish that up. And
yeah.
That's one of the plans for this year.
Gotcha. So maybe moving away from short stories and back into novels.
I never fully left the novels. Just last year wasn't, but finishing. Like I said, the series that I moved over to do is my heroic fantasy series that I'm working on book 7 right now. Which the plan was to do a Kickstarter for that here at the end of the month, but I think I have to push that off till April just to make sure I'm fully ready.
Gotcha.
To do it. Then being a Navy guy, I started writing a Space Navy novel a few years ago that I paused on, and now I want to finish that up this year too.
Gotcha.
So
you want to have multiple
I kind of scattershot all over there.
Why do you choose to do that?
I don't know if it's a choose to. It's a choose to. I don't know. Whatever happens to be the interest at the time. I mean, which sounds weird, but like last year, the reason I did the short fiction thing is because I realized the previous couple of years I had not been as productive as I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do that challenge to kick myself in the pants and get into the groove of just churning words out more and having shorter term deadlines and shorter term goals, I have found in the past helped out with that.
Gotcha.
But in terms of making money, you really need to have the longer works, right? So this year as my last year was my rev up, and this year is the plan is to be focused back to the longer works and use that same momentum to carry it through.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Plus, it's just fun to do short stories sometimes too, just because you can explore a lot and just, you know, get satisfaction of finishing something quickly.
Yeah. Which is more often than not, if I start a short story, it ends up being a novel. I mean, there are some short stories that like are very self-contained and you can just tell like it doesn't need to be any longer. But oftentimes a short story opens up an idea and you're like, oh, I want to develop this.
There's been several in the short fiction challenges that I've done over the years. It's like, oh yeah, that story was fun, but oh yeah, there's a lot more to it. And of course, there's probably a dozen of them I haven't gone back to yet.
When you do short stories, do you send them out to literary journals? You talked about competitions. How do you find the places that you want to send those stories and what's the goal with them?
Writers of the Future, you know, is, I don't know if you're familiar with it, is the biggest writing competition in science fiction.
What is it again?
Writers of the Future. Okay. The full title is L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future Contest. Hubbard was a sci-fi writer and the
founder of
things before he did the Scientology thing. But the Writers of the Future contest, there's a hard firewall between that stuff and the fiction stuff. So he set up this contest back in the early 80s as a way to help give exposure to new writers. Nobody who's professionally published more than three short stories can enter it.
Okay.
Nobody who's professionally published a novel can enter it. The great thing about the professional publishing standard is it keeps going up, right? So I've had a few pro sales a few years back, but they raised the rates on what the pro sales are now. So those sales that I had back then don't qualify anymore. Okay. So it's like, hey, cool. So we can keep on earning. But no, it's like it's done on a quarterly basis and they have good cash rewards, but also you get published in a big old thick anthology and go for a week long workshop and hobnob with, you know, big names in the field and learn from them. And that's pretty much the only contest I go to just because it's the most legit. But you know, you go to Amazon Analog and those guys, you get there's several different back in the day there were several different there's a bunch of different submission what do you call them search
so there's like
things out there like the railenback.com back in the day, and there's a bunch of other things that show the various professional places you can submit short fiction to. And I went through and found a bunch of stuff that was appealing. And if you're on the science fiction side, if you go to SIFWA, which I'm not a big fan of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Association, but they have a list of professional qualifying magazines and sites in there.
Yeah.
You go to all those guys, they're paying per rates and submit to them.
What is author marketing mastery through optimization, you ask? I'm going to tell you. It's the best way for us authors to make a living selling our books. Are you tired of hearing gurus tell you your book is only good enough to be a lead magnet for services? Are you tired of feeling like you have to be a slave to social media and then frustrated when the time you spend doesn't actually help you sell books? I was too, until I found Ammo. Ammo is the only program that reliably produces results, and it works for anyone. Is it hard work? You bet. Do you have to overcome some of your own prejudices to make Ammo work for you? Absolutely. But rather than being another program that rah-rah shish goom boss tries to get you emotionally excited only to offer unclear methods, Ammo shows you how to design profitable ads step by step through a unique, highly tested and targeted formula. The founder, Steve Piper, is a data-loving, formula-driven author who escaped the kingdom of Amazon to build a platform for himself, where he sold directly to his readers and built a loyal following and millions of copies sold. With Ammo, you know who's reading your books, how to contact them, and what they want to read next. If you've always been frustrated with Amazon's wall of mystery of not knowing who's reading your books and losing 50 to 70% of your hard-earned money that you're making through sales, Ammo solves all of those problems by putting you in the driver's seat and showing you how to fulfill your books directly to your readership. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
A major one that you can look for that's been around since 2003 is called Duotrope.com. Duotrope.com has been around since 2003. I think now you might have to pay $5 a month to be part of it, but it has an exhaustive list of all the contests, all of the magazines, anything that you could possibly want. You can narrow it down by genre. You can narrow it down by time in existence. You can narrow it down by acceptance rate. Duotrope is kind of like Listen Notes. Listen Notes is for podcasts. Duotrope is for short story writers or people who are looking to publish journals. You can even narrow it down by the number of words of your story. So some journals will not accept anything over 5,000 words. Others will not accept anything over 10,000 words. Some are flash fiction. You can narrow it down by pretty much anything. So $5 a month is a really good price, but probably Duotrope would be where I would recommend anybody listening go if you are a writer of short fiction.
Yeah, I've used them in the past. I think Raylan does the same thing. But you know, after you look up a bunch of places and you find the stuff that meets your criterion, you kind of just, I have a little spreadsheet where I track where I send things to. And so it's like, all right, I know where to hit this guy, and I've bookmarked everything. So I know to hit this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. And I sort of have gone out of the search thing. Yeah. There's also, there's a lady I used to correspond with who I haven't talked to in a while, and I forget her website, but she has a, I'm gonna have to look her up. It's useless to tell you about this. She was compiling, like, there's a whole bunch of anthologies out there that, you know, put out calls every month or so.
Yeah.
This lady would keep on. Let's see if I can find it.
Don't worry about it. I am curious why submit to an anthology. Anthologies to me seem like they benefit the person publishing them and less so the person featured in them. Because the real issue we have and the reason this podcast exists is because most books don't sell enough to ever really get enough notoriety. So why publish in an anthology?
Well, the problem is obscurity, right?
Of course.
Nobody knows about you, right? So if you can get your stuff out there and get paid for it, right? And that thing goes to people that you wouldn't normally have access to, it's a general plus. A lot of times these anthologies are made, at least the bigger ones, they have a couple of key writers in it who they think will be the draw.
Gotcha.
Right? And then they go and have everybody else in it. So you have somebody who's buying the anthology because they like, you know, the one guy in it, but he read through the other stories in it and it's like, hey, I like that dude too.
I guess my question is, I mean, like, what percentage, just spitball me here, what percentage of people who buy an anthology because they're like, oh, I like that guy, actually read the rest of the anthology? Do you think that that's a high percentage or a low percentage?
Probably not very high. Probably pretty low.
It's an interesting thing to me. I think that anthologies, this is just my experience of anthologies right now, is that anthologies feel a little bit like a money grab. It's cool that they might pay authors to be in them. Most anthologies that have reached out to me to participate are like, hey, we'll give you exposure. And they don't offer any kind of payment plan. So there may be like a handful of them that do offer to pay you for your story, in which case I might think of it a little bit differently. But it also sometimes feels like a distraction. Am I off base in my thought process here?
I don't know. I don't know.
What's your experience?
I guess it depends. I mean, my experience is fairly limited, but but the here's the thing, though, right? If you go with that anthology, maybe you don't have, who knows how much exposure it is. Mm-hmm. That's first publishing, right? So that's burned, but also you can always do reprint rights elsewhere.
Yep.
Right. You can also, you know, put the story up yourself, make your own collection bundles and do all that sort of stuff. So on the one sense, you are sort of burning a bridge because first print rights are gone, but I don't know. I'm not sure how much you're losing, especially if you're producing, you know, stuff on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right. No, if you're producing, you know, not to ding my own horn, but if you're doing 50 stories in a year, like I did 57 last mm-hmm. year, you know, any one story isn't particularly meaningful in terms of, hanging your whole career on. Right. Sure. So you send that out, breadcrumbs everywhere, and it may not be as long as the rights isn't a rights grab. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how you lose from doing it.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from. There's always going to be a slight rights grab if you're giving somebody else your work, because nobody is going to want you.
Most of these things are like, for short fiction, is like you get, they have exclusive for a few months and then you get it back, to be able to do other things with, right?
Yeah.
So, and as long as they're not claiming rights in perpetuity, except to continue on their thing.
I always thought about it a little bit like when I finished my MFA, you run into a lot of journals, you run into a lot of editors. And so you know that maybe you're going to publish something in The New Yorker and they will give you the rights to it to publish a book if they publish a segment of a book that you want to do. Northern Passages or the Missouri Review, some of the really big ones, the Paris Review, all of them will give you your rights back eventually. But what I always felt like was the big win for submitting to journals or potentially anthologies, like there's a handful of them that I might do, is the notoriety. So I will give up 4 or 5 months of my life for somebody to be like, Jody J. Sperling is, New York Times bestselling author, or an author whose work has been featured in The New Yorker or the Paris Review. Those things to me seem like wins, but I wonder sometimes, I'm being serious. I just don't submit to anthologies for this reason, is like, if I tell somebody off the street that I've been published in X anthology, is it recognizable enough that they understand, like, oh, that's a big deal? And if not, would I rather keep those 3 months because the velocity of my fiction will always beat the $5 I'll make for being in the anthology? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you're right? Building your resume is a thing, right? And if you have those, the New Yorkers or what have you, that's or the Times or the USA list, those are things people recognize. And so, I'll give you a little bit of more imprimatur, if you will. That said, you could also, any one particular anthology or whatever may not be that impressive to, Joe Average. If you then turn it around, let's say you say, I've been published in 40 different anthologies, they'd be like, holy smokes.
I hear what you're saying. And I also think of like Ben Lurie. Ben Lurie has been published in like 500 literary journals, but 400 to 499 of them are kind of like irrelevant. Many of them have closed. And I wonder, he can put that on his resume, but if people don't recognize those, in some sense, does there ever become a point where you look at that and you're like, they're not taking their swing, they're not like collecting themselves for the big push? What are your thoughts about that?
I guess I don't understand what you're saying. I'm not sure that it's exclusive.
I don't necessarily think it's exclusive, and I don't think I'm saying it's exclusive, but I am saying, I wonder if it's a distraction to go after anthologies, if there's something actually that we could do that would be bigger. The question I'm asking myself is, why spend time going after an anthology when you're going to be one of 50 people? So already somebody has to commit to reading the anthology from front to back in order to reach you. And it depends on the positioning, because I've been in a lot of literary journals, and oftentimes I'm somewhere around page 37, maybe page 57. So people really have to commit to wanting to read the thing that I wrote in order to even arrive at me. And of those people, then people who read it really have to understand what I'm trying to accomplish. And so maybe a small percentage of them will respond to the story I wrote. Because I've read New Yorker for a very long time. And occasionally, I like a short story enough to find the author. It's so rare that, and I mean, we're talking about like the biggest magazine out there for fiction. It's so rare that I like an author enough to go and find their book that it feels even like that is a gamble. I'm willing to submit there because they have a distribution in the millions. But when you're talking about a distribution in the hundreds, which is what most anthologies are, and that's actually being generous, then like, am I actually just masturbating onto the sand versus like getting out there and really doing something with my fiction where I could have a generation of children who loved what I was publishing? Yeah, I know that's a gross metaphor, but it feels legit to me.
Well, yeah, and that will, and it actually, it is legit in a way. The I think we may be living in two different worlds here. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. You're talking literary journals and things like that. I'm thinking more science fiction, fantasy, you know, analog Asimov's magazine type stuff, and then other anthologies.
Yeah, those are still
like the science fiction,
right. And those are
science
still,
fiction, yes. Magazines. Those are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of subscribers.
They're
each
still
month,
journals, though,
right? And they'll pay you a good amount of money to go in them, mm-hmm. and you know.
You are correct. I think that's a really good point. What I do think is true, though, is that even if you're going into like the sci-fi journals, the horror journals, like Stephen King kind of cut his teeth going into horror journals, but he doesn't submit there anymore. I'm just curious, like staying there, spending time there, you're still looking at like a funnel that is so narrow that I'm wondering if it's worth our time.
Well, how long does it take to write a short story? You can get one done and, you know, if you sit down and actually sit down and focus, you can get one done in, you know, an afternoon. And
that's a good question. Actually, that's a philosophical question more than it is a work question, because I may be able to write 5,000 words in an afternoon, but I might not be able to be proud of 5,000 words for 5 months.
Maybe, but we're often the worst judges of our work, right?
Yes. And we're the only ones who matter. Yeah. Like, I'm always writing for a hypothetical reader. I always want somebody to read my work and delight in it. But until I'm delighted, then I'm not going to give it to them, because if I can't enjoy it, I cannot expect them to enjoy it.
Fair enough. I guess I'm a little more mercenary.
Okay.
in my thinking on that. I haven't put everything that I've written out there yet, just because primarily because I time between the other things I do for cash flow and being a dad and not going insane.
Yeah.
There's only so many hours, right? But there's a couple that I'm like, yeah, I'm never putting that thing out, just mostly because when I look back and read it, it's like, man, that didn't make a complete story.
Yeah.
That didn't, or one, there's this one story I was wrote last year, actually, where I had my deadline. I'm going to meet my deadline. And I'm literally Sunday night at my deadline. I'm literally doing this, falling asleep at the keyboard because I'm not going to miss my deadline. And I wrote it afterwards. I was like, dude, this is totally incoherent. That's going nowhere. Yeah. Right. But at least I finished something. So I guess maybe I just don't have, maybe I'm not self-critical enough. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I also have come up from a different perspective than you, right? Because you did the MFA thing, you did all that sort of thing. I came from a totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm an engineer and I'm a business major guy after engineering school and the Navy stuff. And it was all just push forward. Let's get it done and move on to the next thing.
Right.
So could be I'm misanalyzing, but I feel less of a hang up about that sort of thing than it sounds like.
I don't think that you're misanalyzing. I think that it is worth exploring for all of us when we are creating something that has to be categorized as art. I know that it's a weird word, but it has to be categorized as art. When we're writing fiction, when we're talking about the things that we are trying to pass on to people, we can't just be giving them something to hook them to their phone. So I understand if you're the inventor of Facebook, if you're the inventor of Instagram, if you're the inventor of TikTok, that your goal is to keep people scrolling. I get that. that's totally fine. But if you are a writer who is writing fiction and your goal is similar to TikTok, then I think that you are actually contributing to the problem more than you are contributing to the solution. And the solution is creating people who, when they read fiction, not only love it and have to read the next book. I'll cite Don Winslow as being an amazing example of this. I'll cite Jonathan Lethem. I'll cite Dennis Lehane as being amazing examples of people who write fiction that's so entertaining, you don't realize you're learning anything. I have an autistic son. He loves math so much that nobody has to tell him a story. And he comes home and he's like, I have to memorize the first 100 digits of pi. And you're like, okay, buddy, go do it. And like literally two,
that's yes, awesome.
It is awesome. 2 hours later, he comes and he reads it. You can see it on the stories on my wife's Facebook right now. He literally memorized 100 digits of pi in 2 days. He just spent all his time doing it. It's really, really cool. And I'm proud of him. He loves reading. He loves Harry Potter. I'm not diminishing his experience, but I am saying that for the majority of us, we are not people who are just going to be fascinated by the concept of pi. But if you write a movie called Pi, and you start to explain how pi is so crazy, then most of us for the rest of our lives will understand that the insanity of pi is its eternal unsolvableness. And that's, I think, where we belong as fiction writers. So that's part of what set me on this journey. So the MFA is irrelevant in my opinion.
I get you on there. And I'm can be just as critical of the TikTok thing as you are. And don't get me wrong. I say I'm in it for the money, and I am, but I'm also in it for mainly in it for the fun, and so want folks to have fun with what I'm producing. So, I think that's my primary thing, but also, fun is more fun when it's not brain dead.
Of course. Yeah.
And so, so I think we're on the same page there.
Yeah. What I would say is that from borrowing from the world of the MFA is that there is more literary fiction that is total shit than there is sci-fi that is total shit. Because there are so many people who think that literary fiction just means writing about real life. And that is an absolute lie. Whereas people with sci-fi are like, I have to have at least a good idea. So thank goodness that most people don't write literary fiction in the MFA world, even though they go and get their MFAs. I think what I'm saying is I want to encourage anybody who's listening to do more than just merely entertain your readers. And I want to push this conversation with you, Michael, into a place where we're not just talking about like the small steps we can make, but like what is the biggest thing on your horizon? What are you thinking about in terms when you say you're in it for the money? Because so am I. What are we doing right now that really is actually moving us toward making money and making a full-time living as a fiction author?
Well, last year was my best revenue year in a long time. It was primarily driven by those Kickstarters that I did. It's funny because I correspond with several other writers, obviously, but among them, Dean, who I mentioned before, and I rammed that campaign through him. And later on in the year, he's like, man, I didn't think those campaigns would work because it's short fiction and you're telling people how fast you're writing them and it's going to make everybody hate it. But darn it, they worked. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, how about that? But you know, if Kickstarter didn't used to be a big thing with books, I remember I was back in a writing business conference thing back in 2018 with Dean and a few other folks who were like, we should try to do this Kickstarter thing. So I actually made an audiobook based on a Kickstarter way back, back then. And a few other people were turning stuff. And then, Brandon did his massive campaign, two massive campaigns. And now he's doing another one. And that suddenly everyone's like, oh, Kickstarter. And so now everybody's jumping on it. But
yeah, you're totally fine. I just wanted to put in there. So a previous guest of this episode that everybody should listen to is Michael J. Sullivan with his wife, Robin Sullivan. They actually gave Brandon Sanderson the idea for the Kickstarter. And so it's a really cool episode. It's a ways back. I'll link to it in the show notes, but it's very important for this conversation. And we're going to go fully into Kickstarter. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a really important piece.
No,
because Brandon would have never done what he did without Michael. And I want to give Michael that credit. And Brandon will actually give Michael that credit, but people listening might not know that. So continue forward.
Yeah, from there. Michael's been crushing it in that field for a long time.
Amazing. Yeah. And it's really,
I remember bumping into him and his wife on the K-boards back in the day when they were first getting going, and they had a little drama with their company at one point,
but they left traditional publishing,
they're still crushing it. Those guys are great.
Amazing.
I've never met them personally, but
they're great people.
But from the impression I have, and if I follow him on Kickstarter, he's always supporting other people's projects and helping getting the word out too. So, get back to,
please do,
to answer your question. That's why that's part of the reason why I'm thinking that's the route I'm going this year. Right. I just back in January, I finished up kicking the final volume from last year, and then starting, as soon as I'm ready to go with it in April, this next novel, then I'll do my Space Navy novel in July. And then hopefully that next series that I've started that didn't finish, I'll be able to get that rolling in the fall. Cause the thing about, cause I've got a small mailing list, but a mailing list nevertheless, I've a few social places where I hang out with, but thing I've noticed every time I've done a Kickstarter campaign is never, don't have a huge, there are some recurring people, but there's always new to you guys who show up. So slowly but steadily getting, more eyes on target, if you will. And I'm pretty sure the novel campaigns will do better than the short fiction campaigns from the fact that it's a novel. In fact, I kicked a novel 2 years ago to much better results than any one of the short fiction campaigns I did last year, but all five combined that I did last year ended up to be decent money by my small standards anyway.
Sure. Talk to me about each campaign, how you set them, what your financial goal is to be successful, because many people listening, but not everybody will know that if you don't reach your goal, you don't get anything. How do you design your campaign? Why do you design it the way that you do? And then how do you promote it after you launch it?
I'm four books into a 9-book series, and every single day lately, I find myself thinking, boy, it would be great if I had some central location for all of my notes, all of my plot points, character names, family lineages, you name it. I wish it was in one place because, let's be honest, the way that I am using Microsoft Word as a word processor and have 55 different documents to keep track of all of the series details that I need to access, I'm taking more time opening up files wondering, why did I name this one that? Why did I name this one that? And not getting the information I need. Enter Scrivener. You guys know that I do not advertise for things unless A, I'm using them myself, and B, I think that you could up your game, sell more books, do better marketing, and get yourself in the game better. And that is why I am now partnered with Scrivener. If you use the link in the show notes, you get a 30-day free trial, and then you can sign up as well for a discount. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
Well, Kickstarter, if you don't hit your goal, you don't get anything. Indiegogo, you can set it so you can get however much you collect, whether or not you meet your goal or not. But different marketplaces, different amounts of eyes
on them.
Yeah,
just focus on Kickstarter.
Kickstarter is the bigger one. So I've done stuff on both, but I've stuck with kicking it. In talking to people and reading up on strategy, it seems like the optimal way to go is to set a smaller goal that you know you can meet fairly quickly, right? So, because the Kickstarter has little various algorithmical thingies. So not only are you guaranteed, if you meet your goal quickly, not only do you know you're a small goal quickly and you're getting at least some money, but also the faster the campaigns hit the goal, And the more they exceed the goal, the more Kickstarter is likely to see it and give an extra boost to showing people. They have their little projects we love thing and other ways where they shed more light on stuff. So for these short fiction volumes that I did last year, I just made them like $200 each for the goal. But I set stretch goals to get me up to higher than that, and I was able to meet those small goals like in the first day. And then after that, it's all stretch goal stuff. And whatever your threshold is, if you're a bigger dude and you know you're going to get at least a couple grand for a book, maybe you set the first goal at 1,000 or something, right? So you know you hit it and then go on. Or
have you experimented?
It's less stress because you know you're getting money.
Right. I was just going to ask, have you experimented with like different thresholds? So there's one thought process, which is if Kickstarter is going to force you to collect your goal, then why not just set your goal for $1 and then you hit your goal immediately?
That's a little cheese ball.
Sure. Why though?
Because you also will have costs involved, right? If you're Kickstarter takes fees. And if you use I've been experimenting with BackerKit for the fulfillment side this last year. And I like how they do things because you set up a store, and I ended up making more money from that BackerKit add-on store and aggregate over the year than I spent on fees with them. So I was like, yeah, that's cool. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
No, it's both here and there.
But it's neither here nor there. It's your $1 question. Yeah. But you also have fulfillment costs, right? If you're sending out paperbacks like this that I have been doing to people, there's a cost for that, right? So if you can't set, and that's where you come to your reward tiers, right? You can't set your tiers at a price where it would be where you're losing money to give people what they give. And you also need to be very careful with your stretch goals so that you don't start losing money from giving people more stuff. A $1 goal overall, I guess you could do that, but that just sounds gimmicky.
Yeah, it's interesting. So feels gimmicky. I hear what you're saying. Because it's funny because I want to dive into this. So you contributed to my Kickstarter. Hopefully you've gotten my audiobook and anything else that you purchased from me. And hopefully you've loved it. But I did take advice from Martha Carr. I found Martha Carr off of the self-publishing formula with James Blatch and Mark Dawson. She had been a guest on their podcast. I really liked what she had to say. She was running a Kickstarter at the time for Amon. And so I asked her to be a guest on my podcast, and I said, I will get it out super fast for you so that we can try to pump your Kickstarter a little bit. But I would love to hear from you on what you're doing. And one of the things she said to me is, I ran an initial Kickstarter that I failed. Long story told in another podcast, I'm not going to rehash it here. But essentially she said, set your goals low so that you hit your goal and you get your money. One thing maybe she didn't talk about, but that seemed to be applicable to me, was understand what is the actual gap between what you need in order to produce the thing you want to produce and what the cost is. So let's just use, for example, I have an audiobook that I'm going to produce with a well-known audiobook narrator at a studio that's going to charge me $100 per finished hour. And that actually is a pretty good deal. I paid a lot more than that, but let's just do that for easy math. So $100 per finished hour. If you get 8 finished hours, that's going to cost you $800. Then for your Kickstarter, how much money do you actually have to pay them? I have $400. So then maybe I set my Kickstarter for $400 to cover the gap between what I can do and what I can pay. And then maybe I hit the $400, boom, we're good, but maybe I actually hit 800, right? Do you think about those kind of things when you set up your Kickstarter?
Yes. In fact, the first two campaigns I did were for audiobooks. The first one was successful, but only because the guy who I hired to do the audiobook really wanted to do it. So he contributed the last bid to put it over the goal. The second one failed miserably. And I've come to realize I'm talking to people that probably better just to not have just be an audiobook campaign, at least that's the advice I've been giving. Sure. But yeah, I mean, if you're, and for those two, it was like, this is how much my costs are going to be for it. And that's how I set the goal specifically. Moving forward from there, there's things I'm, your art you get for book covers and things like that, things that you want to recoup. So you recoup if you can. So obviously that goes into the calculus, and editorial costs and things like that.
So when you do a Kickstarter, let me ask you.
So yes and no, because on the other hand, you can almost, things like the art and editing costs, depending how you do your business accounting, you could, there's ways to, maybe you deal with that in other ways. So for something, I guess something that's super concrete and super pricey, like an audiobook, the big stress on, making that cost up. But if you're looking at, paying a guy $300 to do your proofreading, all that stuff, well, that becomes big, decent money too. So something to bear in mind. Yes.
I'm confused. So let's hold up for a sec. I'm a little bit confused. So what's the purpose in your mind of running a Kickstarter? Like why run a Kickstarter?
Guaranteed revenue.
Okay.
Also, it's its own marketplace. So
the
visibility from people who go through there.
Gotcha.
Those two main things, right? Because you can.
Wow. Yeah.
People have been thinking about it from people have been talking in the indie world about book launches forever. And of course, in the New York publishing world, you get advances and things like that. Yeah. Well, this is almost like giving yourself an advance.
Right.
And launching your book at the same
but
time.
But not a guaranteed revenue. So that's such an interesting way that you look at it, because I have not looked at Kickstarters that way in the past. What I've looked at Kickstarters for is give me a sense of interest. Like, am I actually doing the right thing right now? Because if I am, and I send out a DM through Twitter, can I get enough people to back this campaign that I can hit my gap fall? And if I can't hit my gap fall, maybe what I'm doing is not the right thing. Maybe I need to back off.
Testing the market. There's that too.
Because that feels, I guess, like I was Kickstarter.
When I say guaranteed revenue, I meant it from the sense of if you're pretty confident, you set a goal, you're pretty confident you can make.
Yeah,
then that's like, all right, that's the bare minimum you
I hear expect to make from. I think Kickstarter has become something that it wasn't meant to be, and maybe more so when it comes to like the publishing industry, because I feel like when you look at other areas of Kickstarter, people who are launching things have already produced at least a prototype of the thing, regardless of how they succeed. And they're going out of their way to show you like what that prototype is and seeing like, are you willing to back this into the like production phase of the product? Whereas we're not doing that with novels. Maybe we have the novel fully written, but we're looking to get like cover design, typesetting, a print run, like whatever it might be. It's really interesting to me that I think a lot of authors assume that it is guaranteed revenue, which is an interesting perspective to me, because like the guaranteed revenue is the last thing I think about. I'm really excited if I can get some revenue going, but I almost always assume if I run a successful Kickstarter, I'm going to lose money on it. Because it's going to cost me more to get my items out into the world than it is. And also, I'm not as super successful. Like the best Kickstarter I've ever run was $20,000. So I don't know.
That's much bigger than me.
Yeah, what other people are doing. But it cost me well over $20,000 to get all of that out into the world.
Well, I would submit that you didn't price your reward tiers properly.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I want to talk about that too, because like I said, for me, it's a gap fall issue. How much can I afford to pay myself? I could afford to pay more than $20,000 for what I did in order to get it out there. However, if I could make more money, then I could mitigate the cost of production. And if you start a business, suppose like you're a real estate investor, when you go to buy a house, you're going to have to pay 20% of the cost of the house in order to get it. The bank's going to own 80% of it. If you can get renters in, they're going to mitigate the costs. And hopefully you can get them in on a rent-friendly contract where they're going to actually cover the whole cost. You don't always know that that's the case, but it is still the world's best investment that I know of, because you got an 80% loan. So even if they don't quite cover it, you're still actually making cash on cash return well over anything else. So that's how I've thought about Kickstarter. Do you think differently?
Dude, you're missing out on Dogecoin to the moon, man.
Yeah, right. I love that. I love Elon Musk. I love Doge. It's all great. But like talking about reality, what are we doing?
Yeah. I lost track of where we were.
We're talking about Kickstarter and how we set our campaigns. Doge. I know, yeah. Doge is great. My friend Joe Radke and I both owned Doge for a while. I actually sold Doge when it tripled. I don't remember what he did. Neither of us actually caught the whole ride up, but I owned Doge when it was like 0.00004386 cents per Doge. And then it went up and it actually surpassed the cent. Had I held on to it for all that time, we wouldn't be having this conversation because I'd be living in Cabo, right? True.
Yeah, well, there's always the ifs and whats and ands.
Exactly.
And wherefores.
But in setting a Kickstarter, the question is, gap fall versus guaranteed revenue. That's really the conversation we're having right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these campaigns that I just did, right? I put the paperbacks at $12 because it would cost, because I figured out how much each individual one plus shipping would, I think I'd end up with like $5.
So 12 plus free shipping, or do you charge shipping on top?
I actually put shipping in there.
Okay. So you're going to get $12 per copy, and that's going to cover shipping. And then you're going to recoup $5 of profit per copy.
I got to look at the, I don't have it in front of me, but it was, several bucks per, so I'm probably pricing out those tiers so that I know I'm, not going to lose. In fact, each reward tier will be, profitable. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, that's a good question too. We should talk
because I mean, because I mean, I don't know what your 20K project was, but what was it?
The seven-figure marketing mindset for novelists. It's a small book that talks about like the marketing mindset. And I think it's a really important thing that I don't talk about a lot anymore for another podcast. I've talked about that a ton, but it was very successful and it was also failed.
Well, right. So I guess what I'm struggling with is why losing money on a success is – it sort of leaves a sour taste in my mouth there a little bit because why not price it so that you could have made a profit?
Yeah. I mean, so my reason is because I actually think about life on a longer term scale. So for example, right now, this last week I went to Bentonville, Arkansas, and I did happen to make a profit, but I don't think about whether I'm going to make a profit when I go. I think about how far out can I go to reach new readers? So there was a Comic-Con there in Bentonville. I live in Omaha, or roughly Omaha, Nebraska. So it was a 6.5-hour drive for me south. I go, I set up my table, I meet readers, I sell books. I have a QR code in my book. They can scan it. They can become part of the Lucky Nines, and they can dive into this series. If I sell 30 books at that, then I have broken even on travel costs, the cost of lodging, which is zero because I sleep out of the back of my van in a Love's travel stop, the cost of food and the return trip, and also the cost of the show. So I have to sell 30 books. I sold 41 books. So it's not a huge thing for a day, but 41 books is a decent showing. It's not amazing, but it moves forward. If I do that every single weekend, then eventually I start to build a group of readers who really matter to me, and that's profitable. If I lose money, it's okay too, though, because...
Well, yeah, it's a loss leader.
Right, yeah. It tells me where to go next time, how to build this thing, how to grow forward. I think of Kickstarter similarly. I have to produce the audiobooks. The reason I have to produce the audiobooks is because I believe that they are the future. I think fewer and fewer people are going to read papers, and more people are going to listen. And so even though they're not selling as well as paper right now, I believe in the future they will. So having those books read by the audiobook narrator is going to pay off in the future. And it also gives me some legitimacy. There's so many reasons, but I'm willing to lose on the audiobooks right now in order to win on the paperbacks. I'm willing to lose advertising on Facebook right now, which I do almost every single day, because even if I get no sales, I know for sure that I got served 100 to 500 impressions a day, depending on what kind of campaign I'm doing, which means even if people don't love what I'm doing, they're seeing my name over and over and over again. And they're like, huh.
And that's legit. I love audiobooks.
I do too.
I don't listen to them as much as I used to when I was working out of the house.
Yeah.
And when I, you know, when I commuting to and from work was like, and I used to do marathons and century rides and things like that. And you're listening to audiobooks for that. But, you know, Plantar Fasciitis sort of killed marathons for me. But,
what killed marathons for you?
I'm not convinced. I'm not sure that I agree with you completely on the, you know, but if you'd asked me 5-6 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, man, future's going to be ebooks. Future's going to be audiobooks. Mm. People aren't going to do print. But you know what? The, my kids are all ebooks. Give me real books.
Of course. I agree with that. You know, between ebooks and you know, paperback.
And a whole bunch of, and the nefarious nature of tech companies such that, you know, ebooks and audiobooks is merely a license, right? And they can take it away anytime.
Yeah.
So you pay for it, but you don't own it.
Right? Timeout, so real quick. A quick timeout.
I think print is going to, I think print's going to stay there forever because
of that. Quick timeout. When you are beholden to Amazon, what you said is true. When you sell direct, what you said is not true. So I sell direct.
I agree. I agree completely. And when I sell ebooks and audiobooks from my store, I say, hey, here's your file. Keep it.
Belongs to you.
You cannot sell it to anybody else.
Yes. It's already protected, but it is 100% yours. You can never lose it. There's no rights involved here. So that's the one area where I disagree with you is that if you're dealing with Amazon, yes, you are dealing with rights and there's a possibility you could lose it if they change something in the future. But,
I don't even mean my rights. I'm talking from the customer.
That's what I'm saying too. The customer could lose their rights. However, that's not true. When I sell from Shopify, BookFunnel handles everything for me and BookFunnel moves that into their library. Not only does it move it into their library, but it tells me that it moved it into their library. So if BookFunnel went out of business, I could actually still fulfill their book that they own. So there's a slight difference between Amazon.
Oh, 100%.
excuse me.
Yeah, I've got my store set up on WooCommerce and then had that for a long time now. One thing I found for audiobooks, I set up my own podcast and YouTube channel years ago because I liked audiobooks so much. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to read my stuff. And I do. So that's what I've been doing. And now I've got, you know, cleaned up files. And my early stuff was so bad that you know, can't use it, but my modern stuff, I just finished that, published the podcast, compiled the files, and boom, now I've got an audiobook.
Yeah.
Narrated by the author. Yeah. I'm not a voice actor, but narrated by the author is a level of cool.
Yeah, people enjoy that. Yep.
And that's not that costs only time.
Right.
So that's sometimes. I think
so. My good friend,
which is a cost.
Yeah, he's a sometimes co-host for this podcast. He very frequently narrates his own stories. He's amazing. He's gotten so much better. And he does Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs as a podcast. It's growing. It is ready to surpass the size of this podcast, which is currently already a top 1% podcast. So Rich has really kicked some ass and taken some names. And he's given away all of his books for free as audiobooks on his podcast. So absolutely, it's an amazing way to grow an audience, to build loyalty, to build love. We've talked about so much over the last hour. I'd love for people to be able to continue their journey with you, Michael. Tell people how they can find you and a little bit about your style. We know you write sci-fi, but give us like the 120-second snapshot.
Okay. I think if you did my genres in order, it'd really be fantasy followed by sci-fi followed by mystery. the series that I'm finishing up right now, I'm finishing book 7 for right now, is called the Glimmer Vale Chronicles. And started the first book, Glimmer Vale, with the idea of it like being seven samurai, but medieval fantasy. And it kind of warped into a, because the two guys who get hired to protect the village who's being accosted by brigands. But they stayed on as the constables, so it's become kind of a fantasy mystery, fantasy adventure, heroic fantasy kind of thing. We're doing book 7 of that right now. You can find all my stuff at michaelkingswood.com is my website. michaelkingswood.com/store will get you to my bookstore. You can find all my stuff. I mentioned the podcast that is called Storytime with Michael Kingswood. It's on YouTube, Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey, and on the RSS podcast feeds that you can get everywhere. Except Spotify. When Spotify did their audiobook rights grab thing through Findaway last month, I got all my audiobooks off of Findaway and I took my podcast off of Spotify. So I'm not there. My mostly thing that I'm trying to do is just have fun in terms of the stories that I write. I'm not trying, obviously there's themes. Obviously you're never not going to have messages come through in your story. But for me, that's not my central focus. My central focus is it a fun time and go from there. Morality always shows through and you'll always find, my viewpoints in some sense, but I'm not. Some people seem to like to want to preach, but I don't want to. I'm not a preacher.
Yeah.
So just looking to have fun with it. I'm not sure if that makes sense. Is that what you're looking for?
Sure. Whatever you want to tell people is what I'm looking for. I have no interest in preaching to anybody else, but I do have an interest in doing more than simply entertaining, because what a waste. Well,
right there with you.
Perfect. It's been great to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for giving us your time. I will link to everything that you mentioned in my show notes. So people who want to find Michael and learn a little bit more about him, absolutely please click on all of the links in the show notes and we will talk again soon. Thanks, Michael.
Hey, man. Good talking to you.
Thank you for listening to TRBM. The theme music was provided by the ever-talented Christopher Talon. And hey, if you liked what you heard, share this show with other readers, because what's the point of telling stories if nobody's listening?